All right, friends. As I understand, and I did skip a week here, but what you really want me to talk about is reincarnation, which is, of course, a fascinating and a really much more fundamental idea for everything that we're talking about. I mean, this class about death and dying has been, there's been a presumption that in some way or another, I hope that you have been able to embrace that death is a transition but not an ending point. And so then the real question arises, and we've just thrown out the thought repeatedly of reincarnation and touched on the edges of it, like Diane asking, how do we finish karma and so on. But it's appropriate for us to really discuss it in a comprehensive way that gives you a sensible feeling for what this is. I first encountered the idea of reincarnation when I was about 18, which was really when I began to study the self-realization path through the teachings of Ramakrishna, who is a great avatar from the 1800s. And I have very strong samskaras from previous incarnations. Samskaras are impressions. Let me think how to define that word. It's like impressions that are on your consciousness. So if for example, you're born with a great aptitude for music, those are your samskaras. The things that you're born with, that you're already inclined to do, it's impressions from previous lives. That's exactly what I'm saying. I have very strong samskaras. S-A-M-S-C-A-R-S is how that word is spelled. Samskaras. For being on the spiritual path. And for being on the path of India with the India culture and all of that. It's just all, I didn't have any trace of it in my life. But the first time someone handed me a book by Vivekananda, who was a disciple of Ramakrishna, I just like, oh, yes. I didn't have to be persuaded. Yeah, I recognized it. It was so true to me, I just recognized it. The first time I saw Swami Kriyananda, it was just, there was no transition. This was simply it. But the idea specifically of reincarnation, interestingly, it was exceedingly intriguing to me, but just totally out of the blue. And I remember that I started applying it as a possible explanation in situations where I didn't really have another good explanation. And I really just did that for a number of years until it just became the only sensible explanation for what was going on around me. How can you meet someone and just in minutes be really close friends with them? How can you go to a place and just feel so familiar with it? How can you be born with certain talents just so much in place? Many different questions. So I don't ever remember having to persuade myself that reincarnation was true, but I just remember acting as if it were true, and then finally it stopped being acting. It just made so much sense. How could you think any other way? But of course, I had samskaras to be reincarnated. So it was all there. But in a bigger sense, we need to ask ourselves, like, if there is such a thing as reincarnation, and this is a bit of what Gordon was asking, what is it about? The traditional Buddhist and Hindu philosophy is that it's a bummer to be reincarnated and we want to stop doing it. You know, we want to get off the wheel of samsara, it's called in Buddhism. And yet, a much more common or an equally common response was the relative of a friend of mine who had no relationship to this path, but knew that her nephew did. She was an aunt. And she just heard at her bridge club or something about reincarnation. And she said, guess what? We get to come back. She was a wealthy woman enjoying her wealth and it seemed like a great idea. She got to do it again. And, you know, for the Buddhist or the self-realizationist, that's not exactly how we think about it. But to be sincere, we keep reincarnating because we're really not finished. And the strong desire not to reincarnate is not necessarily foremost in our awareness. So you have to back all the way up and you have to ask, what is the nature of life? Before you can understand death or rebirth, you have to ask, what's going on here at all? I mean, the explanation some people have is you pop up out of nowhere, and when it's over, it's over. Which, if that works for you, then just fine. That the inner dissatisfaction with a picture of reality, I mean, the dissatisfaction with a picture of reality has to come from inside you, whether it comes from an intellectual feeling that the argument is flawed or from just a heartfelt rebellion that this life cannot be as meaningless as all that. A young man who is a mathematician, I have no aptitude or particular knowledge of math beyond very simple arithmetic, but he was an atheist, he said, and then he studied math because he wanted a solid science. And he said math made him a believer in God for such a sweet reason. He said, in mathematics, if the answer isn't beautiful and harmonious, it's not the right answer. And so he followed his math like that and loved it. But then he began to realize that the explanation he had for life was neither beautiful nor harmonious. And it crossed his mind that it must be therefore the wrong answer. And so he started positing the possibility of a loving God and a purpose in life, and eventually became a self-realizationist. I always thought that was such a sweet way to look at it. But he was led because the explanations that he had prior to that were not satisfactory to him. Oh, so the question is, basically, why are we born and what is the purpose of life? We instinctively have a sense of what the purpose of life is, which we sort of know in reverse. You can see it a little bit in children, and you can watch it yourself in your own life, which is there is this instinctive draw to both love and happiness, which are really the same reality. Love is a form of happiness, true love. And little children just go there. They go to the things that delight them. They find delight in everything. They have no need to have a purpose in their life, and their purpose in life is just to enjoy themselves. And they enjoy themselves with an inner kind of enthusiasm that everybody finds touching. Swamiji tells this story. It's told by Jim Corbett, who was a big game hunter in India. And he wrote books. They're very entertaining books. And he talked about the endearing quality of babies of all species. And he talked about a tiger that was creeping into a clearing, and he was going to attack this little baby goat. But the baby goat, seeing the tiger, was too inexperienced to know that it was an enemy, and just came gambling over to make friends with the tiger. And Jim Corbett witnessed this whole thing, and he said, and the tiger just didn't have the heart to eat it. And then, as he put it, the tiger, not wanting to appear foolish, pretended he'd come to the clearing for other reasons, and then went away. But even within us, as we grow older and have a little more control over our lives and a little more context, all of our choices are made to experience happiness and to avoid suffering. Some of our choices backfire on us. But if you actually analyze every single decision that you or anyone else makes, it's to avoid suffering and to find happiness, however we define those things. The definitions can be totally perverse, be extremely eccentric or individual, but nonetheless, we're always motivated by those two things. And there's an underlying truth here which is fascinating when you think about it. We know that we're supposed to be happy, because if we didn't know that, we wouldn't keep looking, and we wouldn't be so bummed when we suffer. Because if things are just the way they are, I mean, yes, there are people who are very upset because they can't fly, but most of us don't really spend a lot of time trying to master the art of flying, because it's just not an option, and we know it's not an option. So we're not dedicated to it. We're content not to be able to fly. But we're not content when we're unhappy. Even if we become, we put on a facade of it's just fine with me, it's a rotten world anyway, and what do I care? We always care. And a piece of you is always pushing against it because there's a wisdom in us that we know we were born for bliss, really. And at a certain point, our inner compulsion to understand becomes strong enough that we begin to encounter a transcendent kind of wisdom. I use the phrase Sanatana Dharma in answering Gordon's question earlier. Sanatana Dharma is the ancient Indian tradition that there are realities. They're not just religions, beliefs, and dogmas and institutions. There are realities. Just as in the Western world, we do all this scientific stuff, and it is objectively true that this is how things work. And interestingly, a lot of that scientific objective stuff is proving exactly what Sanatana Dharma has said all along, which is this world is not what it seems. That something completely other that is not material is actually the animating force of what appears to be the solid material world. Sanatana Dharma has always said that that's the case, that this material world is manifested from a higher, more subtle level of energy, of thought, of consciousness, and then that underlying consciousness of everything, including all of us, is bliss. Bliss reduces itself down to joy, then down to happiness, then down to pleasure. You know, the octave begins to descend, but however you call it, it's that directional, and it ends in that state of bliss. We are all, according to Sanatana Dharma, manifested from that bliss, and this material world that we live in is an expression of that bliss that is like waves on the ocean. That's how it's described. That the ocean is the reality, and that the waves go up and down. And the waves are, I'm born in this life, I live this life for a while, and then I go back into the ocean, and then another wave rises, it's me, and I play another game, and it goes back into the ocean. Just like waves rise endlessly, rise and fall on the sea, but the sea itself is always the same. And it's just an image, but it's the image of how all these souls incarnate and appear separate, but then when they die, they never were separate. They just look separate. If you're just looking at the waves, a lot seems to be happening, unless you know where it's coming from. So I've said several times in this class, we can all look at our lives and realize that insofar as we have felt any progression, it's an increase of awareness, and that awareness brings with it some level of greater happiness. Now, it does not always bring greater pleasure or happiness in the superficial sense, but inherently, greater awareness moves us away from suffering and toward bliss because we are able to live in a greater reality. We understand more what's happening. We understand cause and effect in our lives. It's all about expanding awareness. So then the next question, even from our own experience, is what is the upper limit of this? Because when we really make a breakthrough in our lives, it's such a big change when you finally realize something. I'm a fairly, you know, introspective and self-aware person, but influences as simple as the way my birth family molded my character and my worldview, I've learned things. I mean, I came to a very important revelation when I was 50. Just something that was so obvious. Just one day I just realized that a certain attitude I had toward life was completely arbitrary and was totally the result of how I was raised. And for all those 50 years before that, I just thought it was me. You know, just something as simple as that. We just constantly keep learning. So what is the upper limit? How much bliss is possible? Well, the scriptures, the awakened saints, say perfect bliss is possible. All suffering is not necessary if you were only aware on a higher level. Now, if the upper limit is really far, it becomes obvious that not everybody gets there in one lifetime. So is this just like a few, like really special people just manage to have this and the rest of us are just, well, that's too bad for us? I mean, that's what a lot of religions say. You know, if you're one of us and you manage to meet all these rules, then you're free and you get to go, as Swami puts it, in a body very much like this one and sit at the feet of God and sing hymns forever. Swami says, to be trapped in a body and an ego pretty much like this one forever, he said, that's my definition of hell, actually, is how he put it. I do not call that heaven. To just, is this it? You know, that I get to be me forever? We have to then start, it becomes a combination of intuition and learning. You read what the masters say, you hold the Bible, the Holy Bible in your hand, the Christian Bible, and you see the words of Christ and there's some power in there. You hold the Bhagavad Gita in your hand and you read those words, Patanjali, Swami Kriyananda, Yogananda. They tell us things about our own potential that we don't exactly know, but they're still not strange to us. We just get a feeling for it. As Master said, his books have his vibrations in them. And his vibration is of complete freedom and perfect bliss. And so you just kind of touch it, and some of that comes into you. And it doesn't come into you necessarily as this big experience of freedom, but some intuitive awareness of that as my reality comes into you. And then that becomes the force that just pushes you a little farther and a little farther. This is how faith is born. You actually experience on some level that this is true. But then, as I was saying, if the masters are telling us the truth, and if we can see that there's this expansive reality, does it just like stop when I'm 60 and I die, or 70 and I die, or 93 and I die, or 30 and I die? Is that just, boop, too bad? That's as far as you get. That's the end of the story. Or is there some reality that keeps pushing through? And even if you think of yourself just in this lifetime, of who you were as a child, as a young person, as the middle of your life, at the end of your life, you can see that there is, even though circumstances have changed radically, you were always there. You were always there through the whole thing. So what is that you? And the body has shifted so much. No matter how huge the person is, no matter how big a man or woman becomes, they were small enough once to fit in their mother's womb. And that it was still you. I mean, your body has changed so much. What if your body sloughs off altogether? Is that enough to cause you to cease to be? Or will you just suddenly be you without the body at all? And then what happens after that, and after that, and after that? These are just get to be very interesting questions. And if the answer is not harmonious and beautiful, it's probably not the end of the story. So you can just sort of arrive at it almost from just common sense, without even going to scriptural authority. Is this world so cruel that I just get a certain point of satisfaction, and then that's it? I don't ever get another chance? What about the terrible mistakes that we make? This is really bad choices. And the errors, the people that we hurt, or people that hurt us. And then we have these really sad things. Is that it? Is that the end of the story? We just have to live with this forever? Or not? I mean, where does it go? And so all of this just leads to the realization that this just has to be something that's going on longer. And the simplest and most obvious explanation is that we are a big book, and what we call an incarnation is just a chapter. And just like any book that you read, you know, the story builds. And if you open it in the middle, you don't really quite know who all the characters are or why they're relating to each other the way they do. But if you read it from the beginning, you see that it progresses very nicely. And when it ends as a cliffhanger and nothing is resolved, you look at the back and you realize, oh, there's 300 more pages. I love long books, you know. We can just keep going until all of this finally finds a conclusion somehow. Now, the force that brings us back to reincarnate is really very simple. It's unfinished business. And that unfinished business is not just with each other. It's unfinished business within our own selves. Have I understood what causes suffering and what gives me joy? Am I able to live yet according to what I know is my destiny, which is perfect bliss? And if I haven't, then if things in this world are still able to completely shake and confuse and anger and cause me to react, if people, circumstances, my own inner self causes me to react and lose touch with that inner bliss, well, I have a lot of unfinished business. You could call it unlearned lessons. There's something I don't yet know about reality. And in a, that word is karma. It's unfinished karma. It's karma that draws us back. And karma is an unlearned lesson. Somehow or another, these circumstances happened in front of me, and I didn't respond according to the highest reality. I allowed myself to become frightened, angry, to lack faith in God, to feel disappointed, whatever you might say. I had potentials I didn't have the discipline to fulfill. Who knows what it might be? And those stay with us. They register in the chakras as vibrations of energy. They don't register as things. It's not like unpainted pictures, blank canvases that are sort of stored there, but every thought or feeling or idea or response that you have, if you want to think about God realization and perfect bliss is 1,000, and the most horrible way you can live in this world is 0, and everything in between reflects some sense of yourself, some idea of what's required to make you happy, some what do you identify with, what are you attached to, what can rattle you and throw you off course from what you know is yourself. And let's just say all of those have numbers from 0 to 1,000 with all the decimal points that you need to make that work. And your chakras correspondingly, are the little repositories for certain sets of those numbers. I mean, this is a very simplistic way of putting it, but you get the picture. And every time you do anything, and thoughts are powerful too. I was talking to someone today who, our community of Ananda, we're very intuitive, all of us. People often who think bad thoughts about someone and then that person responds to them as if they were not, that something bad had happened, and the person will defend themselves by saying, well, I never said anything. Your thoughts are powerful too. That's your self-definition. That's the energy you're vibrating. To commit yourself to action or words is a step more, but thoughts are plenty. So at the end of every day, all the energy that you've put out in that day has not just gone off into God knows where, because we are identified with ourselves. It just stores up in the chakras as vibrations of energy. The chakras are what's called the astral body, the energetic body. In the movies, you know how when the physical body falls over and the same actor gets up, only he's a little transparent, he can walk through the walls? That's pretty much exactly what happens. And when you stand up, when you're in your physical body, you've got the nerve plexus and the heart and the lungs, and that's all the stuff that dies, because that's all material. But behind that, actually animating that, the blueprint for that is the astral body. And the astral body is not physical. So the physical body dies, just like I would take this off and I could still walk, but I could leave this behind. This is what I did the first night, as I recall. I dropped my scarf on the floor. And so there we are. So you drop your physical body, but your chakras go with you, which is to say, honey, you can't just escape it by dying. Because all the vibrations of consciousness that you have become in the course of a lifetime is who you are now. And you live in the astral world, the energetic world, and that vibration takes you to the appropriate astral plane. And if you're a bad person, you go to hell. And there are stories, good stories, I mean, well-written, interesting stories about near-death experiences that ain't so pretty. Where bad people go to bad places, and they do. And fortunately, the few stories I've read, when they come back, they've learned One man, a very interesting one, he was a very outspoken atheist, and he did his best to destroy the faith of people. And he had a death and return experience, and he went to a really bad hell because he had hurt so many people by preaching with force this untruth. And when he came back, he was just horrified by what he had done. He just created so much ugliness and doubt and fear that he became a deep believer. He lost his professional position, his family, because everything was based on his cynicism. But he saw the consequences of it. This is not beautiful and harmonious. It's blasphemy. So we go wherever we will go. And God is not cruel just because, you know, you haven't been as nice as you might have been. He takes the overall picture. You have to realize this. And so most people go, you know, to a decent place. And if you're a really good person, you go to a beautiful place. But nonetheless, you're also carrying all those unlearned lessons. Oh, if only I could have married so-and-so, he was so beautiful. If only I had been sweeter to my daughter, she wouldn't have been alienated to me. Oh, I just love that house, and I really wish I could live by the sea. Every time you have a thought like that, it stores, it registers. And so you're up there in the astral world, but there's all these unlearned lessons that require a return to the material world to be able to experience them. And so you kind of hang out there for a while, a shorter or longer period of time, just depending on many factors that I couldn't articulate. And then after a while, the pull, the necessity to finish the job, all the unlearned lessons, it begins to pull on you. And I joke about things, and I don't even know if this is true, but you're in the astral world, and you know, the Henry, who's the one you really married, wanted to marry instead of Fred. But, you know, Linda got to Henry before you got to Henry. So you're up in the astral world, and you see that Henry is reincarnated, and oh my gosh, so is Linda. Boom, you're down there again, you know. Because it's pulling you. You want it. Or you begin to think how nice it was to be admired. You know, and I saw a picture of a movie star once, and man, she just was such a movie star. She was such a movie star. I looked at her photo. I don't know what it was about her picture. How many lifetimes have you been working to look and be just like that? You know, to have that particular. So, what if you're a starlet and you've tried so, you spent your whole life trying to be a star and you failed? Where does that go? It doesn't go. It stays. So you rest for a while, and then it begins to start up again. And it feels, it's the same kind of restlessness if you'd resolve to have a quiet evening at home. I mean, I've had many, because I have complete freedom of my own schedule. Oh, well, you know, today, now I'm just really going to sit at this computer and I'm just going to answer all these emails. I'm really going to get this done. But I'm a little hungry. And gosh, there's really not much in the house. But ooh, that omelet down at that California cafe is so good. I'll just slip out and go get one. You know, I'm fine, I'm working, and then all of a sudden this restless desire comes. So you're in the astral world and you're having a fairly happy time, and then this restless desire. I want, I need, I have to. And then you find yourself in a little baby's body again. Just there you are. I'll tell you another one that I just love. You, on some way, and I don't think it's as mechanical as this, you choose your parents, you find the right place. Master actually says this: if a soul wants to be born and he sees a couple that he wants to be, then Master said the soul will project erotic thoughts into the room. Some people have told me that they conceive children in a most unusual manner, that they really believe that, that there was somebody forcing them in that moment to create the opportunity for the soul to come in. And this is a very fascinating world. I have no way to respond to that. But I just love it. Did I tell you the story of my friend and her 5-year-old son? This, my friend, I met her when her son was grown, in his 20s by then. And when I was talking about this, Master said, when the sperm and ovum come together, there's a flash of light in the astral world. And all those souls who are in tune with that light and ready to be reincarnated, he used the phrase, will rush to try to get into the womb. And he said sometimes more than one will enter, and then you have multiple births. And when I said that in a class, this woman came up to me afterwards, and she said when her son was 5, and she did something like mothers do, that enraged her little boy. And he was so mad, and he declared, "I hate you, Mommy. You're a terrible Mommy." And then he ran out of the room. But he felt that he hadn't really said enough. So he turned and he came back, and he looked at her like this. He said, "You weren't even my first choice." She didn't know anything about these teachings. She'd never even thought of the idea. But she was fascinated. "Honey, who was your first choice?" And he said, "A lady in the Philippines, but she was taken." And then when I talked about this, about rushing in like that, she talked about her son. She said her son has this lifelong characteristic. He makes up his mind. He's going to do something. He starts, and then he stops and reconsiders. And she could just see him going for that womb in the Philippines and then just stopping for a minute to think about it, and whoop, somebody else got in, and he had to settle for her. I have no idea about the truth of it, but there is something to that. And because the vibrations, this whole world, it's an energy universe. It's all magnetism and energy. It's not things. It's energy forces working. So you have a certain vibration in your chakras that together, let's say, makes a certain a radio signal or a tracker beam or something like that. And there's a situation in the material plane. And Master says there are lots and lots and lots of planets. We don't just come back to this planet by any means. We're not earthlings. We're just souls living on Earth. We can be anywhere. Let me finish one thought, and then I'll give you the question. And so when we're ready to incarnate, we're vibrating in a certain way. And in all of creation, we find exactly the spot that will allow us to run that cycle. And that cycle is however many unlearned lessons we have that can be worked out in that body, we will do them. And the moment it's finished, we die. Whether that's 3 years old, 30 years old, 95 years old. Sudden unexpected young death is one thing. But it's very interesting when you're with people, if you ever sit with someone who's dying, they just die when they're going to die. You know, you can't rush it, and you can't delay it. It's just like there's an exact moment when the energy shifts and they're gone. So your concept of good is pleasurable and easy, whereas from the soul's point of view, good is that which enables me to learn what I don't know, to expand my awareness, to become more and more powerful and more defined by my inner consciousness and not by my outer circumstances. That's one explanation. Good and bad, you have to really stop and ask yourself, why do I think this is good? We think good if it automatically makes me happy. We think bad if it challenges us to have to work harder to be happy. But if you're thinking from the point of view of, well, if you go to the gym and you always just put 2 pounds on and say, "Look how strong I am. I can just lift any weight at all. Look at this." And then we walk out exactly the same as we walked in. So we want to be born in such a place that never asks anything of us. But is that really progress? Is that really good? Or is that just simply easy and pleasurable, which is how the ego wants it? That's half the explanation. The other half of the explanation is, and this is a harder one, you reap what you sow. Now, and that's a creepy one, especially if you have really, really, really tough circumstances. But this is a mathematical system. There's nobody up there just saying, "Well, I like you and you bribed me." They refer to God as the unbribable judge, which you are vibrating in a certain way, and this is exactly what you need. And this is just the way it is. I can't remember exactly what the details of it are, but the point is the point. Some person had a clubbed foot, and someone asked Master why that man was born with a clubbed foot. He said in a previous life he kicked his mother, which is he just showed such disrespect for the one who'd given him life that he. That created a fairly low number. And so he had that bad energy. Maybe you had good parents at one time and didn't appreciate them. Maybe you squandered certain privileges and now you have to work to get them back. Maybe you were your mother's mother, but we're very in love with some man over here, and this child was a bit of a nuisance, and so you tried to... I mean, just imagine a circumstance, and I certainly don't have any trouble imagining myself doing things that I would not be proud of now, where temptation, opportunity, longing, selfish opportunity would come to me, and I wouldn't quite have the strength of character to make the noble choice. And so what happens, what's the consequence of neglecting a child? Well, self-evidently, you may be a neglected child. And I'm going to throw out one about sexual abuse of children, which is always the one that scares everybody to pieces, especially if you've been subject to it. But I'll give a possible picture of this one that I found helpful. What if you are a woman madly in love with a man who belongs to some other family, but you don't care, and you do everything you can to pull him out of his family? Maybe you successfully pull him out of his family. Maybe you just make his life miserable by your constant determination to have him with you. Maybe you swear to heaven and earth, and in all circumstances you want to be with him, you don't care. So you get to be with him. But you know, all of a sudden it's not what you wanted. But your unlearned lesson about the selfish determination to have what you want regardless of the consequences, suddenly you get what you wanted, but the consequences are not what you expected. Now, I mean, I know that I'm not trying to push that on anyone. That was presented to me by someone else as a possible. And that's not saying that children are not innocent, so please understand me properly. But just as a possible. So I think what a person has to ask themselves, if you find yourself in any kind of a circumstance that's difficult, you know, that was imposed upon you, sudden loss of that which you really felt. You have to just ask yourself, what is the unlearned lesson here? You know, what is coming out of me? Don't ask so much, I mean, even that sort of explanation about, you know, a totally inappropriate connection with someone, that you can imagine how you could find yourself being caught in that. But when something that you don't understand happens to you, ask yourself, what is it bringing out of me? Don't even necessarily look at the circumstance itself, but ask, what is it bringing out of me? You know, is it bringing out anger? Is it bringing out lack of faith in God? Is it bringing out this nobody loves me and nobody will ever love me? Is it bringing out this deep sense of worthlessness? And that's your unlearned lesson. It's just as simple as that. Whatever, the details are not important. It's what it shows you about your consciousness, what it shows you about your unfinished business. And so circumstances will be arranged that in and of themselves are not that important, but what they bring out of you is the point. Because, for example, extremely difficult circumstances, child abuse, sexual abuse, terrible parenting, can make you so powerful and conceivably so compassionate and just so completely independent of circumstances and so incredibly able to help other people. It just is a question of what it does for you. And you can say it's bad or good, but if that which was challenging and not pleasant is the cause of everything that you've accomplished, well, was it bad? Or was it good? See, that has to take us back to, what is life? Why are we here? Why are we born? Why do we die? And you can't just take a piece of it. I mean, you have to work your way to the whole thing. But you just start piece by piece and see where you're going to go. Well, Becky, let Gordon ask a question first. You receive from those who are more advanced, and you pass on what you receive to those who don't know what you know. And everybody knows something that somebody else doesn't know, and everybody knows something that you don't know. And you keep the cycle running. That's one of the things you learn, is that we're here to serve. We're here in mutual service to one another and to give. Until eventually, and there is perfection at the end of it, you finally realize who you are, and then the whole story stops at that point. or you become one of these great helpers who has no... Jesus said he was born without sin. The word in the Bible, sin, if you use the word karma, it's better. Jesus didn't have any karma. He had no unlearned lessons. He'd learned it all. He just came back to help the rest of us. And all the rest of us have karma. And he came to help us sort it out. Like that. And it becomes very, I find it very relaxing, actually. Because, and I also find it a tremendous incentive to get on with it. You enter into a state of perfect bliss that never ends, nothing touches you. It's a state of consciousness so far beyond what I live in that I can only point to it. The masters, this is the state of a Christ. This is Jesus, Yogananda, Buddha, Krishna. That they're utterly untouched. They live only in their inner consciousness. And even if they take a body and use it, they're never subject to it like we are. Yeah. And so consciousness never stops. But the compelling necessity to reincarnate is gone. You may choose to serve others, but you have no unlearned lessons of yourself. But of course, you put on the costume and you play the game. You go on the stage with really good makeup and a fabulous look, you know. But you still have to play it through. That's why Jesus had such a dramatic life. They all have such dramatic lives, but they're free inside. They don't identify with it. The purpose of life is to identify with our lasting self, with the eternal self, not with the passing self. You know, Becky, Diane, John, Asha, these are passing identities. And we've all had these conversations about people who have died. And all of us have dear ones who have died. And I mean, Swami Kriyananda left a year ago. And they're just so gone. There's this most astonishing goneness about them. And it's over. However, and I'll use Swami as an example, the essence, the spirit that we enjoyed through that body, especially with a soul like him, you're still there. You're still experiencing it. So it's a question of self, of what you identify with. So I deeply identify with being Asha. I do not feel like an African man. I feel like an American woman. But the life essence, the soul essence of an African man is identical to the soul essence of this one, but I identify with this one, and all my experiences are based on this one. I'm just not an African man. I'm an American woman. But my true nature is infinite, and my true nature is bliss, but I deeply identify with this, and this is ego. Ego is the infinite spirit identified with the limited body in which it resides. And in order to become free, we have to identify with the infinite spirit which resides within this body and not with all the things that come with this body. The best way to overcome the ego, this is from the scriptures, the best way to overcome the ego is to give your energy in service, in loving, sensitive service to others. Because then I am expanding my identity to include their welfare, and by the constant discipline of having to think first of someone else's reality and not of my own, I gradually weaken the identification I have with this limited one. If you combine that kind of service with inner communion, with inward spiritual practices, the combination of the two is really potent. Because you meditate, you sit in the silence, you raise your attention to the spiritual. I mean, there's so many complications. Let me phrase it. Complications, not the right. But there's many pieces of this, and I'm only giving a part of it. If you meditate properly, by that direct experience that you have daily or several times a day, you're also discovering a reality that is always there even when the body is completely unengaged. So if you're doing those inner communion practices and actively using your outer energy to constantly identify with welfare other than just my ease and my pleasure. And the combination of the two becomes very potent. And the result is that you form an entirely new definition of yourself. And you just realize yourself to be part of a greater reality, to be as much in other people's well-being as you are in your own, and that your consciousness is not dependent on your brain and your body, and it all comes together. Master said if the missionaries, who were very, very self-sacrificing, also meditated, he said they would have made great spiritual progress. They made much less because they didn't understand how to directly transcend their identification, but they had transcended their self-interest to a very large extent by doing that kind of giving up everything, so much of what their individual bodies would have thought of as good. Does that make sense? Those are very subtle ideas, but they're very important ones. And that's why we just incarnate over and over again until we get it. And so someone like Swami Kriyananda or Paramahansa Yogananda or Jesus Christ, people we've been thinking about a lot, Jesus just walked right in and he just gave them his body and let them crucify it. You know, but it wasn't as people imagine it, this horror that he went through. He was not identified with that body. He was identified with the infinite. And so he just gave them his body. He let them kill him because it was necessary for the whole story. And then he just put it back together and came back. I mean, it's a fabulous story, and from the point of view of self-realization, it's completely understandable. You know, it's a very clear story. And it's a much better story, in my opinion, than the one that the churches give you, which is just like this, he just appeared and did this strange thing and suffered so horribly and let us think again about how much he suffered and how horrible it was for him. And then, bingo, we're all saved. It's like, it doesn't work for me. It's not just because I'm Jewish. It just doesn't work for me. The self-realization version works great. Well, there may in fact have been a big bang. All I can give you is what they say. And among the things they say is the level of consciousness that asks the question can't comprehend the answer, which is my favorite, sorry, bud, can't answer this question. The divine spirit manifested us. There are what they call days and nights of Brahma, in which all of our little individual spirits just hustle around trying to sort it out. I don't know. I guess I really can't answer. The only answer I know is that Swami Kriyananda says, anybody who actually finishes the project and gets all the way to God realization doesn't think it was a bad deal. And I don't know. I really don't. Well, in a sense, it doesn't matter because, see, that's how I've never worried about theoretical questions that wouldn't change my experience. I would do the same thing. I'm suffering. I don't want to suffer. I'm not able to accomplish what I want to accomplish. I want to accomplish it. I'm short-tempered with people around me. I want to be nice. And how I got into this position is not going to make me any better. So I like the things that make me better. And I've discovered that when I start following those, there's just some kind of increase of awareness that also comes, which they promise me in the end I'll know. That works for me. It doesn't work for everyone, but it works for me. Oh, no, nothing would happen except my body would die and that everybody on the bank would start screaming. It was this place where these two huge rivers came together in Deva Prayag, it's called. Two big rivers, and you could stand, because it's India and they don't have the same like litigation systems that we have in America, you could just step right down to the edge. And I just was aware of how tiny the physical body was. That's what she's talking about. And I was not suicidal by any means, but I just realized that I just step into the water and like that, I'm gone. You know, this whole big thing of being Asha, it's just gone. And of course, as I said, this whole crowd I was with would start screaming behind me and I would be in the astral world just like that. But it wouldn't accomplish anything, so there was no point in doing it. But it gave me a very delightful sense of eternity and the power of God and how wonderfully little we are in all of this. Before we reincarnate, it varies a great deal from soul to soul. You can, I mean, people talk about spending hundreds of years in the astral world, and some people reincarnate, like that very famous, relatively recent story of the boy who was actually killed in the Second World War, went down in his plane, and was reborn and was able to go meet his old colleagues who were still living, although he said to his mother, "Mommy, they're all so old." Because he knew them when they were all in their 20s, but he exited and they just kept living. But he recognized them by their voices. I think it just depends on your karma, how strong. I mean, now that little boy is an example. He was in his 20s. He was furious to be killed. He hadn't even started his life. So his intense attachment to this world, but even then he waited from what, 40 years, maybe 50 years, to recover from the trauma. These are things I couldn't answer. But it can vary enormously. You can get quite attached to the astral world. It's very pleasant. It's kind of like, how long can you stay in Hawaii before you have to come back to work? That's how I think about it. Some people can stay longer in Hawaii before they come back to work than others. Well, actually, there's several answers to that. I mean, if you did not respect your life, if you did not use it properly, perhaps even if you took your own life, Master said, it may be hard for you to get another life, another body. So you'll have a desire to be born, but that desire will be thwarted. Or you may just change your mind. Or you may have karma with the people involved. And any number. I mean, you can just play out any scenario in your mind about all the different pieces of that, and you can think about why those things might happen. Who's part in what reason? So, I know many women these days have had abortions, and they don't like to think that the soul was actually present. But Master says that the soul comes in at the moment of conception. But the karma of what we just do what we think is best at the time, and God is merciful. We can't be held accountable for what we don't know. If you are in such suffering that you choose suicide, the karma of that is you have to come back to exactly the same point of suffering and then have the courage to seek a solution. So the big problem with suicide, really big problem with suicide, is that it accomplishes nothing. I mean, if it accomplished something, that would be, let's go for it, but it accomplishes nothing. You just postpone, and then you have added in also, you've set up a samskara of defeat, and you've weakened yourself. And so then the next time, you'll meet people, maybe some of you are those people who are, I had a woman friend, and just every time anything went wrong, no matter how small, the tea is cold, I think I'll go throw myself off a building. It was like her mindset was always that the way out of this is to kill myself. And she had to constantly struggle against that thought. And, on one hand, I talked to another woman who had those thoughts, and she was so relieved when I could just have a conversation with her about it. Yeah. It's probably a karmic habit. And so you have that habit in your mind. Just like somebody will say, I think I'll go get a drink. I don't feel so good. I think I'll go have some whiskey. I feel a little uncomfortable. I'm going to go buy a pair of shoes I don't need and can't afford. I feel a little uncomfortable. I'm going to go find some man to sleep with. We find ways of trying to solve the problem in something other than actually facing into it, having the courage to go through it and expand our consciousness. And in a very impersonal way, it's all just a misunderstanding. No matter what you're doing, it's just a false idea of how to avoid suffering and how to find happiness. And sooner or later, you will figure it out, because unless the answer is beautiful and harmonious, we haven't solved the equation yet. And if you're in the middle of the story and it's really crummy, or somebody you really love is in the middle of the story and it's really crummy, that's all right. They'll figure it out. That's why the masters, even though they're very compassionate, they're very calm about it all. They're not all panic-stricken. Because, as Swami said about something else, about the diamond, compared to eternity, time is not very much. People can suffer longer if they want to, but in the end, they will stop suffering. And when they stop suffering, they will never suffer again. And then the suffering will be seen to have been just an illusion. It's like if you imagine that there's a snake, that a piece of wood is a snake, and you make all these elaborate reactions to it, and then realize it was just a piece of wood, it was never a snake. So even if you think you had all these terrible experiences, when you wake up from the dream, just like if you have a nightmare, you wake up, oh, it never really happened. So they tell us, this is where you end up. It makes you much more relaxed. Not always, but generally, much less reactive. You're just looking at the whole thing from a different, completely different angle. So why don't we go and affirm that? We're going to go outside and light a fire. And with the fire, we will recite these mantras. Mantras are power sounds. These are Sanskrit mantras. We have handfuls of rice, and rice represents seeds of karma. Every bit of rice can multiply and make a bazillion other seeds of karma. When you meditate, you burn the karma directly before it sprouts. You know, before it sprouts. Meditation, this is an iteration of meditation. But so we hold rice in our hands when we do this fire ceremony. We burn up the rice, and so we're just burning up all these. We're transcending all of this karma. We don't have to live through it. We're just going to throw it away because we've already figured out the end of the story. Why bother? You know, I was crying about something. I was very upset, and I lay down on my bed to cry. And as I was lying there, I thought, whenever you cry, Asha, your eyes get really red. You get really tired. It takes you hours to recover. You have to sleep. And in the end, you're just going to be exactly where you are. So I just got up and stopped. I just got up and stopped crying. So that's sort of like you cut the karma off. We'll just burn it. I don't need to cry. I'm just going to get rid of it right from the start. And then we'll take a piece of paper and write on that piece of paper a prayer, an intention, either to repudiate or to receive. And then we'll do a second mantra and we'll all just burn those papers and we'll do all that together.